which you can find in your pew Bibles. And it's sometimes tricky to find, but it is on page 1 of your pew Bibles. Genesis 1, 26 through 31. Listen for these words. Let them sink into your hearts this morning. Then God said, "Let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the wild animals of the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." So, God created humankind in His image. In the image of God, He created them. Male and female, He created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth." God said, "See, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given you every green plant for food." And it was so. God saw everything that He had made, and indeed, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. This is the word of the Lord. Will you please pray with me? Oh God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts on the scriptures that we have read today be acceptable in your sight. For you are our strength. You are our Redeemer. You are our Sustainer. Amen. On Wednesday afternoon this past week, many of us remember how the sky grew incredibly dark. It was like nighttime in the middle of the afternoon. And then the winds started blowing. And those big trees along the driveway of Center Reformed Church, they started to creak and lean, and they were straining in the wind. And I was really worried that they might fall. And then the rain just dumped, and the air turned silver and gray. And then after a few minutes, I heard it rather than saw it. Thump, 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 thump. Pea-sized hail was coming down, bouncing off the cars in the parking lot, melting quickly in that downpour that turned that church driveway into a flowing stream. There was no damage to Central Reformed Church, although George, our facilities manager, says that the sound of hail on that new glass in the atrium is pretty amazing. When I got home that night, I checked out my own house, and to my dismay, I found out that the wind had knocked over one of my apple trees, right there in the backyard. The roots did not seem to be broken, but they had sort of twisted and popped up out of the rocky soil. So there I was, I had this 15-foot apple tree lying on its side, and I walked over there and gave it an experimental lift, but it was way too heavy to budge. I decided to let it go and look at it in the morning. But in the morning, I was faced with a decision. What was I going to do? I'd not planted this tree. The soil where we live is very rocky. And maybe the previous owners didn't dig down deep enough. I wasn't guilty for its shallow hole or the winds that knocked this apple tree over. But I had to do something about this tree that was lying in my backyard. And the question was, what? What should I do? Should I try to stand the tree back up and save it? Should I just give up, cut it up, and use it for firewood? What is my responsibility toward creation? How much of my time, how much of my money and my energy should I spend in caring for this environment? Now, the Genesis 1 passage that we read today has a very long history of use in the church. Many scholars, pastors, Christians have used this passage to direct or condone their behaviors. We are to have dominion over the earth, they yell. And then they clear-cut forests and destroy ecosystems without any regard for anyone. The historian Lynn White is one of the scholars who has noticed that this tendency to destroy nature and rape the earth comes about because of the orthodox Christian arrogance toward nature, which follows the imperative of the Genesis command. White goes on to blame our Western attitudes of exploitation of the earth in part on this Judeo-Christian dominion theology, this dominion theory that views all of humanity, all of people, much more superior to the rest of creation, and that all of creation just is below us and exists only for our use. Now, thinking about this dominion theology, I came up with a few problems with it. The first is that dominionism is basically a selfish theology, one that puts human wants above non-human needs. And as a human-centered theology, dominionism leaves no room for God's handiwork to exist and glorify and give praise to God, our Creator. A clear-cut forest and extinct animals do absolutely nothing to reveal the glory of God to anyone. So I think we should be wary of any theology that gives human desires the highest priority and places human greed in the driver's seat of a bulldozer. My second thought about dominionism is that there's no room in it for loving one's neighbor as oneself. There's no place for considering the plight of the least of these. Now, a dammed and redirected river may benefit the recipients of the water, and homes and businesses and, yes, even churches could be built because of it. But in dominion theology, there's no room to consider the plight of the poor Mexican farmers who, now due to the river's new use, live beside a dried-up stream bed. They don't seem to count. In our global environment, the biblical mandate to love one's neighbor as oneself seems to be rather incompatible with this type of dominion theology. The two ideologies don't seem to fit very well together. So, how do we reconcile this Old Testament injunction to have dominion over the earth with this New Testament responsibility to care for our neighbors? Could there be another way to interpret Genesis 1, 26 through 31? Perhaps there could be a clue in the context of the passage. You see, in the ancient Near East, there were basically two choices when it came to a person's relationship with the land. The first was a nomadic lifestyle. The earliest nomadic peoples, they hunted and gathered only what nature provided. And later, some pastoral nomadic people, they moved herds from one pasture to another, and then they lived off of the herds. Now, nomadic lifestyles are extremely difficult, especially those pure hunters and gatherers who didn't have animals to rely upon. There was no way to store large amounts of food. You would have to carry it with you. You had no control at all over what the land yielded. You were at the mercy of what you could find, what other people had not already taken. Now, the alternative to this nomadic lifestyle was that of an agricultural society. And I believe that this type of agricultural stewardship is the dominion that is referred to in Genesis 1. Instead of living only by what the earth naturally provides, in agriculture you cultivate the earth. You plant the food that you will eat. You harvest it. You save back some of your seeds to plant again in the spring. You tend to the ground and you keep it watered and you watch for it and keep it healthy. Agricultural societies were the ones that can produce grain and grapes, which allows for the making of bread and beer and wine. This ability to store grain leads to increases in population, which allowed people groups to be fruitful and multiply, according to our Genesis command. I don't think that it's any accident that in the Genesis account, which is set in a garden, if you will remember, that this Genesis account sort of promotes this type of agricultural connectedness to the land instead of a nomadic lifestyle. When you think about it, agriculture in the ancient Near East was not an easy task. Just imagine farming without tractors, without even a rototiller. There were no Home Depot stores where you could go to buy a tempered steel shovel, and there wasn't even a Sears catalog where you could order an iron plow. Farming was initially done with sticks and rocks and hardened clay implements. They had no pesticides, no chemical fertilizers, and no garden hoses. Instead, the materials taken from the environment were used to subdue the wild land into a fertile land. And through hard work and careful planning, the land became a partner in human existence, rather than a wild and unpredictable force which sometimes worked against human survival. I believe that this Genesis passage about dominion of the earth is not a license for exploitation of God's creation for human benefit, but rather an invitation to partner with the earth through agriculture. Even though we have this blessing of agriculture in Genesis 1, the well-being of the land was never ignored. In Leviticus 25, we find something very amazing. There's a divine commandment to allow the land to lie fallow and untilled every 7 years. To do such a thing in the ancient Near East, and even now, is virtually unheard of. But the fact that God's laws of Sabbath, God's time of rest and rejuvenation, was not only mandated for the human population, but also for the environment, tells us that the needs of the earth are very much to be considered and to be given place to. This is not a law which could have come from a human-centered domination theology. The stewardship and partnership with the earth as an entity in its own right is important to the God of Leviticus. Now, no matter where you stand on the political environmental issues today, we can all agree that humans have not been very good stewards of this planet. The New York Times reported the other day on the efforts of Beijing to improve their air quality in time for the Olympics. This coming week, Chinese officials are going to begin to park truck traffic in order to try to clear the air of smog. 300,000 trucks are slated to be removed from the streets, and in the later part of July, half of the motor traffic will not be allowed in the streets. And if all of these huge plans, which were going to totally disrupt everything, do not work, Beijing has a contingency plan to shut down many of the smoke-producing factories in northern China as well. All of this to clear the air so that the Olympics can take place and that the athletes and the visitors can breathe. Now, lest we think that only people far away are guilty of destroying the environment, we should today take a hard look at our own backyard. The Grand River runs like a backbone through this community, and it has the largest watershed in the state of Michigan. Grand Rapids is one of the major cities in the lower watershed of the Grand River, and this watershed covers a total of 10 counties. On the EPA's website, there is a listing of the impairments this year to the Grand River and to its watershed. In 2008, just this year, the Grand River has recorded high levels of mercury in the fish, making those fish unsafe to eat. We also have a lot of PCBs, those toxins from old industrial waste, and those toxins are simply just sitting on the river bottom. They're not going anywhere. On Thursday, July 3, just this past week, due to the big storm, a no-contact advisory was declared on the Grand River. A no-contact advisory means that you're not even supposed to touch the water. The reason? It's because 70 million gallons of our untreated, raw Grand Rapids sewage, teeming with E. coli, was running past the parks where we were about to have our 4th of July picnics. Just what do we think we're doing? We are killing these invertebrates, we are killing our fish, killing our environment, and ultimately killing ourselves just because we cannot view our neighbors as our brothers and sisters, and because we only want to see a good bottom line on our own personal balance sheets. We have come a long way from the nomadic lifestyle of those pre-Abrahamic Semitic wanderers in the ancient Near East, those who were the victims and at the mercy of what the land could provide for them. But we have now left that realm of partnership with the environment and are now part of a lifestyle that's so disconnected from the land that we need to be reintroduced to agriculture through the farming exhibits which are at the museums. Abraham Joshua Heschel, a Jewish activist and a theological scholar, was a great proponent of renewing our relationship to the environment. One of his most famous quotes is that, in a free society, some are guilty, but all are responsible. Let me say that again. In a free society, some are guilty, but all are responsible. While the people who are currently sitting here in this sanctuary may not be directly involved in releasing heavy metals into the watershed or allowing raw sewage to flow into our rivers and streams, there are some people who are indeed guilty of these actions in our community. And all of us, as Christians and stockholders, board members and citizens, we are called to be responsible for seeing that such guilty actions are stopped and that the beautiful and great environmental resources which God has gifted to us, we have the responsibility to make sure that they're available to everyone, including our children and our grandchildren and those we don't know, and especially the least privileged who are in our midst. On the 4th of July, after the Granville Parade, Bill and I set about the task of righting our fallen apple tree. We took a long length of chain and we hooked it to a cable puller mechanism, which we connected to another tree nearby. Inch by inch, as Bill moved that lever, the fallen apple tree in my backyard slowly stood upright again. Now, we don't know if our efforts to save that tree are in vain. We don't know if that stress of falling over and lying there for a couple of days was too much for those strained roots. There's no way for us to tell if the next storm will cause that tree to snap its tether and to fall down again. But we are committed to working in partnership with this great environment that God has given us. And I invite you to also join us in this responsibility. Amen. In your bulletins, you will find a response, which is from the Belhar Confession. The Belhar has been adopted on a provisional basis for us to use in our worship. You please stand with me. We believe that God has revealed Himself as the one who wishes to bring about justice and true peace among men, that in a world full of injustice and enmity, He is in a special way the God of the destitute, the poor, and the wrong, and that He calls His church to follow Him in this, that He brings justice to the oppressed and gives bread to the hungry, that He frees the prisoner, restore sight to the blind, that He supports the downtrodden, protects the stranger, helps orphan and widows, and blocks the path of the ungodly, that for Him pure and undefiled religion is to visit the orphans and the widows in their suffering, that He wishes to teach His people to do what is good and to seek the right, that the church must therefore stand by people in any form of suffering and need, which applies among other things, that the church must witness against and strive against any form of injustice, so that justice may roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Amen.